Hello to you all and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Hassan here with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, Quebec's $11 billion deficit is a result of its own fiscal choices, say researchers and opposition parties.
They started off with huge surpluses. They were very generous, so they sent out checks and they went with a tax income cut. And then all of a sudden, they realized that the economic context is not what they thought.
The Alberta government spends $5 million to boost women's shelters across the province.
Because shelters are there round the clock, 24/7, to put an end to gender-based violence. They're there for those who are seeking their services, and they're also on the front lines of prevention.
Ontario farmers are bracing for unpredictable weather as spring arrives. Dams in Nanaimo, British Columbia, are in bad shape and could kill hundreds if they fail, says an expert.
The concrete is in really bad shape. Being underneath that bridge there, I've been done the inspection. There's concrete falling on you, exposed rebar, all those great things.
In Nova Scotia, the Queens County wind farm is getting closer to reality. 33 wind turbines are planned near the Mercy River in Milton, giving local residents a truly green power alternative.
It is a good thing for Queens County, and it is one that should be welcomed by people who understand green energy is the important energy.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome to the show. Our first stop will be in Quebec today, where the finance minister, Éric Girard, tabled a $158 billion budget on March 19th. Spending will be up 4.6% with increased investments in education, health and social services. But along with that comes the largest deficit the province has ever seen, projected at $11 billion. Opposition parties have been critical. Parti Québécois leader Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon linked the record deficit to tax cuts the government made last year. And Quebec Solidaire leader Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois decried the lack of investments to fight the housing crisis and climate change. Colin Pratt from the Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique and Éric Gingras from the Centrale des Syndicats du Québec Union talked about this year's budget and what they'd like to see going forward. More on this with Jules Bugiel in Montreal.
Quebec Finance Minister Éric Girard tabled a $158 billion budget on Tuesday. Spending is up 4.6%, including moderate investments in education and health and social services. But along with that comes the largest deficit the province has ever seen, projected to be $11 billion. This deficit stems from a difficult economic and climatic context, but it's also necessary to improve right away services to the population. It's necessary and it's manageable. But Colin Pratt, a researcher at the Montreal-based Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique, says the economic context is only part of the story.
There are two factors that are contributing to this deficit. First one is the economic context, the rise of the inflation and the slowdown of the economic growth lowered the revenues of the state of Quebec. So it explained partly the reason why we have a deficit of $11 billion for this budget. The other reason, and this one is interesting, is because of the choices of the government itself made in the last years about the fiscality, that the taxes were lowered last year.
One example he's talking about here is from last year's budget, where the Coalition Avenir Québec lowered the threshold for the first income tax bracket from 15 to 14%, and from 20 to 19% for the second.
So that 30% of the deficit we now face is directly caused by the revenues that the government does not have now because he decided to lower the taxes of the population. It's a choice. It's a political one. And now, today, the government faces the consequences of its own decisions.
It's a sentiment echoed by the opposition, too. Here's Parti Québécois leader Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon.
I think they're under pressure. They started off with huge surpluses, and they were more than optimistic. They were very generous, so they sent out checks, and they went with a tax income cut. And then all of a sudden, they realized that the economic context is not what they thought. They never had the gains with the federal, so there are billions are lacking. So they're trying to balance this budget as they can, but there's no guarantee that we will reach 100 million next year and 200 million the next year in efficiency. But the real issue for the election will be, okay, 8 years, what's up with all the key crises that you were supposed to fix? And you see the budget, there's not much. So the chances are it's going to stay as critical as it is right now.
A debt always has to be put in relation to the GDP of a country, of a state. Well, Quebec has a lower debt to GDP now than prior to the COVID crisis. So in terms of debt, we're not in a bad situation. So right now, the priority of the government should not be to go as fast as possible to a net budget where there would be no deficit, but it should rather be to make sure that the public services are finally getting better after such bad years in the last years. Yeah.
Now, the budget does have some big-ticket investments in health and social services, where spending saw a 4.2% increase, and education, which got a 9.3% jump. But RBC economists say other areas of public spending saw a decline from last year, including infrastructure and social housing, which they say fell 4.9%. Québec Solidaire leader Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois says that needs to change.
The government said it's going to be healthcare and education. Well, one thing is missing. It's housing. In the middle of the worst housing crisis in 40 years in Quebec, it should be a priority to build more homes. The other thing we should do is invest massively in public transit. Today, there has been not one new public transit project funded and launched by the Coalition Avenir Québec. Not one project across all Quebec. It's unacceptable.
Last fall, Montreal's Regional Transit Authority, the ARTM, announced a major 5-year deficit. Quebec agreed to cough up around $250 million of what was needed to keep buses and trains running this year, but hasn't made any new announcements since.
Just for this budget, the public investment in roads have risen of 10%. While public investment in public transit only rose of 0.29%, so less than 1%. So in terms of mobility and viability of the mobility of the population, it's bad news.
Even in the areas that saw the largest increases, the numbers don't necessarily tell the full story. Here's Eric Chanclas, head of the CSQ union, which represents over 200,000 public sector workers in the province. They work primarily in education, which saw the largest increase out of any public sector category.
It is 9.3% for this year. If you count in it the money that has been saved with the strikes that happened a few months ago, yes, it comes up to a 9.3 increase. But if you put that aside, because that amount have been a bunch of that amount, around 300 million, have already been injected for kids to have a follow up after all the strikes. The real number is 6.7% increase in education. That's the real number. And if you take this number, it still only finance the maintenance of services. It's a number. It's a big number. It's close to a billion. So you could say, oh, there's the investment. But the real deal is that it's money that was announced back in November, and that's going to be continued next year.
Last fall, around 500,000 public sector workers went on strike, winning around 17% salary gains over 5 years. But they were also asking for more public sector investment to get hospitals and schools back to pre-COVID capacity. After this budget, they say they're left looking to the years ahead.
There's investment, not enough, because people want better services, but still, now the focus is on next year and the year after to be sure that we're not going back to history.
I'm Jules Pujol. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang.
Women's shelters in 17 different communities throughout Alberta are getting $5 million from the provincial government to help bolster their services and increase their capacity. The government made the announcement on March 19th. The communities of Banff, Brooks, Calgary, Camrose, Cochrane, Cold Lake, Edmonton, Fairview, Fort McMurray, and Grand Prairie are set to receive funding, as are those of High River, Lloydminster, Morinville, Rocky Mountain House, Sherwood Park, St. Paul, and White Court. According to the provincial government, Albertans can get 24/7 support by calling or texting the Family Violence Info Line. Support is offered in more than 170 languages, including all Indigenous languages spoken in Canada. Details with Ryan Hunt in Edmonton, Alberta.
Shelters in Calgary and Edmonton getting some help, as well as shelters in Fairview and St. Paul in the north, and High River and Brooks in the south. Jan Reimer, the CEO of the Alberta Council of Women's Shelters, spoke on the importance of the funding that is a step towards putting a stop to gender-based violence.
It's been 10 years since women's shelters had any kind of an increase. So if you look back over that decade, we've seen population growth, we've seen inflationary pressures, we've weathered a pandemic, we're seeing increased demand, so we know how needed this funding is. And I know it means a great deal to our members and the staff and the boards that support them. Because shelters are there round the clock, 24/7, to put an end to gender-based violence. They're there for those who are seeking their services, and they're also on the front lines of prevention.
For the funding aspect, $5 million will be split between all of the shelters immediately, and another $5 million will be given out over the course of the next 3 years. I'm Ryan Hunt.
Don't forget to tune in to all our stories on frequencynews.ca and write radio at frequencynews.ca, radio at frequencynews.ca.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
Last Monday and Tuesday were very popular days in Canada and in Nova Scotia's South Shore as well. Not only because spring arrived, this time because councillors of the Region of Queens approved a development agreement on March 19th to allow a large-scale wind farm to go ahead in Milton, Nova Scotia. This means that Queens County residents are one step closer to a purely green electricity option. Halifax-based Rosewall Development Inc., the owners of Mercy River Wind, plans to build 33 wind turbines on about 80 hectares of crown land near the Mercy River. Rosewall Inc. promises to sell power from the wind farm directly to consumers and adds its power rates would be lower than Nova Scotia Power's. David Howell, Rosewall's chief financial officer, says he hopes the development will be up and running by the end of 2025. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, has more details on the plan.
Queens County residents got one step closer on Tuesday to buying their electricity directly from wind energy. Region of Queens councillors approved a development agreement to allow a large-scale wind farm to go ahead in Milton. Halifax-based Roswell Development Inc., the owners of Mersey River Wind, plans to build 33 wind turbines on about 80 hectares of Crown land near the Mersey River. Roswell promises to sell power from the wind farm directly to consumers, bypassing Nova Scotia Power, under the name Renewall Energy. It will offer electricity to large customers on the South Shore first, and then to residential customers. The company says its power rates would be lower than Nova Scotia Power's, and the project is expected to employ 100 people temporarily. The company says it could employ up to 12 people full-time after the farm is up and running. David Howell is Roswell's chief financial officer. He was at the council meeting on Tuesday.
We will be delivering the electricity across Nova Scotia Power's grid, paying for the use of the grid, essentially. And people will have a choice by the time we get to, I hope, the end of 25, to buy their power either from Nova Scotia Power or directly from our retail company.
Roswell is the first in the province to be awarded a license to sell power directly to consumers under the Renewable to Retail program introduced by the provincial government in 2015. Under the municipality's land use bylaw, large-scale wind developments are not automatically allowed in the area as it's currently zoned, so the company had to apply for a separate agreement with the municipality. As part of that process, the municipality held a public hearing on Tuesday morning before its regular council meeting. Only one member of the public spoke against the project. A Milton resident was concerned about the proximity of the turbines to houses in the area and an effect known as shadow flicker. That's essentially the shadow cast by the turbines on properties on a sunny day. Mitch Underhay is Roswell's development manager. He said after the meeting that all homes are at least 2 kilometers away from the development, and one woods camp is about a kilometer away, but the company has reached an agreement with that landowner.
And that's part of the environmental assessment process, is that the shadow flicker gets modeled. And there are limits of basically how many hours per year and minutes per day the shadow flicker can land on a receptor, which is usually a home. All of the homes around Milton are well outside of that, so they shouldn't experience any shadow flicker at all.
The owners of two concrete companies spoke in favor of the development agreement. Bridgewater Ready Mix and South Shore Ready Mix hope to win some work with the project. Joel Weston, president and owner of Bridgewater Ready Mix, told councillors there are many advantages to the project: local jobs, greener energy, and potentially lower power rates.
We in the ready mix industry also have a commitment to net zero, and to achieve that we need renewable power, and we intend to become customers of the Mercer River Wind Project once it starts.
Mayor Darlene Norman said the project could eventually generate up to $800,000 a year in tax revenue for the municipality.
It's a great development agreement. It's been several years in the making, many public meetings. It is a good thing for Queens County, and it was wonderful to have 100% approval from council on this matter. It's a big project for Queens, and it is one that should be welcomed by people who understand green energy is the important energy.
Securing the development agreement with Queens County was one of the last steps before the company can begin construction. Howell said they're in the final stages of working at a lease agreement with the province for the Crown land in Milton. The development agreement approval is still subject to an appeal process until April 4th. Howell said they hope to begin construction by this summer.
Thanks to Rick Conrad.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. You're listening to Viewpoints.
Unpredictable and unseasonable weather continues to mark the forecast in Ontario. The Wellington Federation of Agriculture and their president, Barclay Knapp, are preparing for whatever Mother Nature throws their way. Knapp says it may be too soon for a summer prediction as far as the quality and yield of crops, but he says adapting to changes in weather is crucial for local farmers. The ideal weather for Knapp, that would be temperatures similar to the week of March 18th. So, as spring gets off to a cold start, following a warm winter, Riley Gillespie Wilson in Fergus, Ontario, caught up with NAP to learn more about the local perspective of the local federation heading into spring.
With spring starting Tuesday and erratic weather patterns continuing to dominate the forecast, the Wellington Federation of Agriculture is bracing for anything that comes their way. President Barclay Knapp says whether the strange weather will have any bearing on crop yield this summer is tough to decipher.
It is too early to tell. As a friend was reminding me, the last 2 years have been a little weak for hay production because last year was too wet. You couldn't get the hay off. The previous year, there was too little moisture, so hardly anyone had enough hay to cut. It didn't really grow. It's too early to tell because the weather could significantly shift.
Knapp added, with the mild winter can come a lack of ground moisture and pests that don't go away. In Knapp's mind, the best possible scenario would be trends in the forecast similar to this week.
Right now, perfect forecast. I would say, you know, rain or snow, you know, once a week to help build up the soil moisture and get ready for spring. Maybe about this temperature we have right now, not too harsh, not flooding us, and just not too cold that we can be out in our machine shop.
Knapp went on to say the early portion of summer has also been radically different since he was a youth.
I know the last 2 Mays, we've had a lot of good luck in Ontario and Wellington County, where most people by the May long weekend have had their corn all planted. And I can remember when I was younger that May long weekend, that's when, you know, we had the big push on our farm to finish picking rocks so corn could get planted the next week.
Learning to adapt to extreme shifts in weather is key, Knapp says. He added Wellington County, a very diversified farm industry, supplies hefty portions of Ontario's crops. I'm Riley Gillespie Wilson.
We'll close up shop this week in British Columbia, where a dam safety engineer told the Nanaimo City Council that there would be serious consequences if dams that the city owns and maintains were to fail. David Benin, a senior hydrotechnical engineer with Hatch Limited, said at Monday's Governance and Priorities Committee meeting that he's concerned that at least 2 of the city's 10 dams could fail if an earthquake hit the region. The story by Mick Sweetman in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
We are majorly concerned about that Middle Colliery Dam because it has been found to be susceptible to a seismic and has been out of compliance with the regulation for a while. And South Fork is actually one that we know is extremely vulnerable.
In Nanaimo, the 10 dams in the city range from low to very high for the level of consequence if one were to fail. The old Reservoir No. 1 dam, which was emptied about 9 years ago, sits at low, but the Jump Creek, South Fork, and Lower Colliery dams are categorized as having very high levels of consequence in the event of a failure. That means if the dam fails, up to 100 people may die from the flooding, damage to the infrastructure and the city's economy would be very high, with severe damage to residential areas, and significant loss of environmental or cultural values would be impractical to restore. As the owner of the dams, the city would be liable for any damage or loss caused by the failure of a dam if one were to fail in a way that could have been detected and prevented. The Middle Colliery Dam is categorized as a high-consequence dam. That dam has been under an order to bring it up to provincial standards.
Honestly, I mean, as a dam safety engineer and a dam engineer, I really like this dam, even from an aesthetic point of view. And it's got a lot of history. So it's actually a really important recreational, historical, cultural, and natural space for the city. It's quite well used. It's a really neat space. I really like it. But there are some challenges. We need to perform some maintenance to preserve the dam. You can see in the picture on the right, the concrete is in really bad shape. Being underneath that bridge there, I've been done the inspection. There's concrete falling on you, exposed rebar, all those great things. And we need to do some of this restoration / maintenance work with also respecting the public users' wants and needs, because we do understand that this is an important space. And frankly, I do want to preserve it for future generations because it is a big part of your history. We also know that there's a strong community desire to preserve these types of spaces, including the lower colliery also. But there are some realities we have to face.
Bonin says he has personally inspected the condition of Middle Colliery Dam.
The concrete side of it is in advanced state of deterioration. We also know that the spillway is undersized. It's been that way for a while. And unfortunately, the regulator also knows this and has really been pushing us really hard to try and address these issues for a number of years, and we've been working on that also.
Bonin says that while the consequences of a dam failure would be very serious, the city also needs to make sure that people who use the dams as swimming and fishing spots are safe too. He says there's been over 300 documented deaths at dams in Canada, compared to 11 deaths from dams failing in the past 100 years.
Dam safety looks at failure of dams and losing containment of structures, but public safety is more the day-to-day operation. How do we guide the use of our dams safely? We know that people use our dams, people recreate near them, but they're also not really aware of a lot of the hazards that they may be facing, and that's a big problem.
Mike Squire, the city's manager of water resources, says the city has taken steps to ensure the safety of people who use the lakes and reservoirs for recreation.
We've had many deficiencies that we've been trying to address over the last several years that need to get done to satisfy not only dam safety requirements, but ensure that we're protecting the public. A lot of fencing and signing has been put up over the last couple of years. And then the spillway boom was extended on the middle colliery, or pardon me, the lower colliery dam.
Bill Sims, the city's manager of engineering and public works, said Monday's presentation was to remind council and the public of the ongoing risks with dams in the city.
Part of the rationale today is to introduce the whole topic, not only to council, but also the public. And just to, this is a refresher. We're back again, you know, and certainly previous efforts were concerning for the public, and we acknowledge that.
This is Mick Sweetman.
At Viewpoints, our reporters were Jules Bougiel, Mick Sweetman, Ryan Hunt, Riley Gillespie-Wilson, and Rick Conrad. Thanks to our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to write. We love to hear from you. Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. See you next week. Ciao.